live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, as ICE raids increase nationwide, rural communities are on the edge. We'll speak with Rural and Migrant Ministries about what immigrant families are experiencing, how communities are responding, and the critical legal rights everyone should know. Plus, how a shoplifting arrest in upstate New York summoned ICE and separated a family. The case represents one of the first tests of the Laken-Riley law in the state. Tonight in Rosendale, the new Pulse Pride Coalition shines a spotlight on legendary singer-songwriter Janice Ian with a special documentary screening celebrating her life and legacy. As Pride Month continues, Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar has this report and Science Stories with Joe Johnson and the free cover summer concert series in Honesdale. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. An overnight curfew has expired in Los Angeles. Mayor Karen Bass implemented it after several days of protests against federal immigration raids. Some of the protests turned violent. Steve Futterman reports downtown L.A. was mostly peaceful overnight.
After four nights of violent confrontations, it was a welcomed quiet here in downtown L.A. The curfew went into effect at 8 p.m. local time. There were still several hundred people in the curfew area. Police established lines moving towards those gathered and gave them time to leave. But for those who still refused, eventually there were arrests. Mayor Karen Bass says the curfew was necessary as the violence escalated.
Many businesses have now been affected or vandalized.
There were nearly 200 arrests on Tuesday alone before the curfew went into effect. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
The curfew covers 1 square mile of downtown L.A. The mayor says it's limited because Los Angeles encompasses more than 500 square miles. The mayor says there's been a torrent of disinformation published online about the protests. A federal appeals court in Manhattan is hearing a case this hour brought by President Trump. He's seeking to overturn his conviction on 34 criminal counts last year in New York State Court. Trump was convicted of falsifying business records in 2016 to conceal a sexual encounter with Stormy Daniels. Trump continues to deny paying the hush money. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf says he hopes to move the matter to the federal court system.
Basically, Trump was tried, convicted, and sentenced in the New York state court system. His lawyers have tried and failed twice before to get the case moved to federal court, essentially hoping it would get dismissed that way. And they keep citing a specific law that allows federal officials to make such a move if the case involves conduct while in office. But it is yet to work. Remember, the hush money payment at the heart of this case occurred before the 2016 election, when Trump was still a candidate.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reporting. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Labor Department reported a smaller-than-expected jump in prices last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials gained 60 points in early trading.
Inflation remained relatively tame last month, even as President Trump's worldwide tariffs took effect. Falling prices at the gas pump helped offset rising prices at the grocery store. The overall cost of living rose just 0.1% in May, slightly less than forecasters had expected. Trump's tariffs may have contributed to higher prices on things like appliances and toys, but overall, goods prices were flat during the month. The cost of clothing and new and used cars was down. Egg prices, which have been a pain point for many shoppers, continue to fall in May as the nation's flock of egg-laying chickens gradually recovers from widespread avian flu. Over the last 12 months, consumer prices have risen 2.4%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. Billionaire Elon Musk has issued an online apology to President Trump. He and Trump traded insults last week, and the insults grew increasingly personal. It all began when Musk started criticizing the multi-trillion dollar tax cut and spending bill now pending in the Senate. It's backed by Trump. Musk now says his online posting about Trump went too far. Last weekend, Musk deleted some of his online posts. After nearly 40 years, researchers trying to develop a vaccine against AIDS say that they are closer than ever before to delivering one. But as NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, a series of cuts by the Trump administration threaten that progress.
Developing a vaccine against HIV is challenging, in part because the virus evolves really fast. That means it's good at dodging the immune system. One of the leading HIV vaccine research projects was aimed at designing vaccines that coax the immune system to produce something called broadly neutralizing antibodies. They work against many variants of the virus. The project was slated to start clinical trials next year, but the Trump administration canceled the grant late last month. The move comes after the administration ended other U.S.-funded HIV vaccine efforts. Altogether, many researchers fear the moves will quash hopes of getting a vaccine anytime soon. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
New Jersey held a primary election yesterday. Republicans picked former state representative Jack Cittarelli as their gubernatorial candidate. Democrats have selected Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. As immigration enforcement actions ramp up across the country, fear and uncertainty are growing in rural communities, including right here in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. In recent weeks, local residents have reported ICE raids at businesses and in neighborhoods, prompting concern about the legal rights of immigrants and how best to respond. Joining us now is Juana Cortez de Torres, Immigrant Legal Rights Project Director at Rural and Migrant Ministry, the organization that works to empower rural and immigrant communities across New York State, to share insights on what she's hearing from immigrant families, what legal rights people should know about during potential raids, and how community members can stand in solidarity and protect one another. Juana, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you for being here. Part of Rural and Migrant Ministry's work is to assist people in understanding and protecting their legal rights in rural New York and throughout the state. What are your initial reactions to what we're seeing nationally and how that might impact your work and the local communities that you serve?
I think first and foremost, what we're seeing is national outrage. And that outrage is based on the randomness of the current policies of the current administration. As such, our work is impacted, and as a result, we go into training mode. And one of the things that we do in the migrant rural community is that we do Know Your Rights presentations. And those presentations are oftentimes in the immigrant's language of origin, which for the most part is in Spanish, and where we go through the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment. And we talk about what happens when ICE comes to your door. What are the requirements that they're supposed to have if they do that? What happens if they go near or around your sanctuary spaces? Education is critical and is part of the RMM mission. And so that is primarily one of the things that we focus on. We do train the trainer groups, and that is where we teach both our immigrant friends and allies about the rights that immigrants have. After all, their rights are our rights.
What have you heard so far from immigrant communities about how they're feeling right now and how they're preparing for the possibility of immigration enforcement in their neighborhoods?
They're anxious. They're nervous. They're worried. The reality is that most immigrants have been in this country for a very long time, and therefore you have something called a mixed status family, where you may have an undocumented family member, but you have citizen children. And that, of course, creates a lot of anxiety. The what ifs are horrible. And so what we're trying to do is we're going to be issuing something called the Menu of Hope, and that will be a resource for our allies that basically guide and give individuals the information that they may need. Being prepared is the most important thing at this time.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that impact that it's having on the community, especially among children and youth, and especially with those mixed status families. What impact have these enforcement actions had on children?
Well, kids are afraid. They're afraid. They go to school. thinking that perhaps they're not going to see their loved ones when they get home. And that, of course, that impact is not only a social impact on their behavior and how they learn, but then it's also the stress involved in that. The thought of being homeless, right? The thought of not having your mom and dad there, or aunt and uncle if they're your caregivers. It's a tremendous impact. And I'm sure the educational community, our social workers, our school psychologists are really called to really stand up and try to help and ensure that those kids are going to be okay. And therefore, some actual school districts have issued policies that basically where they give their educators and their administrators guidelines of the what if I go to the school. And that's tantamount. Education at this point, knowing how to respond to the type of action that we're seeing nationally is critical. It is critical.
We've heard from NPR News about some of the folks in Los Angeles and how they're reacting to the federal immigration raids there and the increased presence of military and National Guard troops. It's causing a chilling effect. Some folks afraid to even leave their homes. Some folks afraid to go to school, to visit local businesses. Is that having a chilling impact here across the country in New York?
Yes, it is. People are afraid to go to the supermarket. People are afraid to shop. I always say that one of the things that this administration is not analyzing is the economic impact. What is it that the immigrant community brings to this country? And it is money, tax base, power. Small businesses survive on the purchase power of immigrants, and also large businesses. And that includes Home Depot. And that is one of the things that issue in Los Angeles of picking people up in Home Depot, it really shows you how far and how desperate the government is to pick up people that, one, may be looking for work, two, may be buying equipment and material there. And it also shows the mixed message of the administration. We were told, the community was told overall, we're targeting people with criminal backgrounds and histories. Well, what happened? Why is it now that you're picking up people on the street? And those people, as reported, the majority of those people do not have criminal histories. In fact, they have immigration remedies at play. And allegedly, they don't know about those immigration remedies and pick them up anyway. It is that randomness that creates the anxiety in the community, that creates the fear. And if mom and dad are afraid, your kids are afraid. Everyone in the household is afraid. And so what happens? You don't go out to shop. You don't go to the local laundromat. You don't go to that little store that you went to. So it's economic impact on all sides.
Here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania, there have been several instances of ICE raids. Just 2 weeks ago, three individuals detained by ICE at a restaurant, a pizzeria in Honesdale, with at least 20 to 30 community members outside the restaurant to document and protest the raid. Let's talk a little bit more about the legal and practical preparedness that you mentioned. What rights do everyday people have if they see a potential raid, and what do you advise people to do?
First, I advise people, if you're going to protest, you have to protest peacefully. It is a distraction to do otherwise, right? That's number one. Number two is, if you're there and you have your phone, you have the right to record, and record it, because that becomes history. It becomes a document that perhaps can be used in the defense of that individual who may have been wrongfully detained, right? Number three, if you know members that are being of the community that are being detained, reach out to that family. They're going to need your support, right? The other thing is, make sure that if you know the family, that they gather their important documents. because you will need that. The community will need that. Individuals reaching out to those detainees will need that information in order to find out where they have been taken to. So number one, protest peacefully. Number two, record. It's a document. It's evidence. It's what we need to see, because I don't think anyone is going to forget about that student that was approached by masked ICE people. And it was shocking. It was chilling. You know, it brought us back to another time in history. And that's another thing. History tells us what to do, what we're supposed to do. And we cannot consent to this kind of approach. It needs to be what it said it was going to be. People that presented a safety hazard to our community. And that does not appear to be the motive here. The motive here, it's numbers. That's what's happening now. And that's why it's so random.
And if someone thinks they see ICE or other immigration enforcement agents in their neighborhood, who exactly should they share that information with?
Well, some communities have what is called as a rapid response group. But if there's not a rapid response group in your community, there are organizations that can help you. The New York Immigration Coalition, they have a number, they can help you. In addition, there's an organization called Immigrant Arc, based out of Albany, New York. They can also assist. It's a consortium of not-for-profit providers that get together to do policy work, immigration training, and as well as, rapid response. That is very important to have. So if the community of allies can gather and have a plan as to what preliminarily we need to do, then that is an approach to take. You need a rapid response team.
Are there any current policy efforts, either at the state or federal level, that Rural and Migrant Ministry or others that you know of are supporting to push back against this aggressive immigration enforcement?
Well, one, of course, is legislation that is currently in Albany right now called New York for All, that actually prohibits the disclosure and basically the cooperation of law enforcement with ICE. And that becomes very important. We're not saying that you cannot have that cooperation, but it must be in conformance with our constitutional rights and the law. So that is legislation that we are supporting at this time. And I think that hopefully the legislators in Albany will really seriously look at it and see its importance given the situation that is happening right now nationally, where you have allegedly a Marine and other law enforcement in Los Angeles. You know, you really need to look at that. And so you have an example of what happens sometimes when you don't have laws that really protect all individuals.
And New York Times reporting this morning that cities across the United States bracing for fresh protests as these Marines prepare to deploy in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. The last immigration raid we see, ICE confirming, they're going to be more, they're ramping things up, and we can see this increased presence of military personnel. What would you like to share with folks before we go that you want them to know? And also just for you personally, working with such vulnerable populations, what is it that gives you hope to keep going here in face of this painful time that we're all experiencing?
I've been an attorney for over 30 years. For over 30 years, I have helped poor people, whether they're immigrants or whether they're non-immigrants. That's what keeps me going. The fact that I believe in the law, and I believe in the law in this country. And if you look to see what challenges have gone to the courts, we're on the right side. We're on the side of justice, right? We're on the side of justice, and we're looking at arbitrary and capricious and random acts by the administration. And the fight will always continue. I grew up during the civil rights movement, and I've seen what a coalition of people who believe in good and justice go forward and really make a change in this country. And I'm never going to lose that hope. Right. And for the community, here's what you have to do. You have to have an action plan. If you have a filing either with the United States Immigration Services or with Immigration Court, make sure you have copies of the documents that show that you have some kind of filing going on. Gather your biographic information, your documents, your birth certificates, your driver's license. Those things become very, very important because if you're detained by ICE, you will have to do a search on the ICE detainee locator. And there you will have to know the legal name of that individual, their date of birth, and home country. And if they have a proceeding before immigration court or USCIS, they have something called an A number. That number is the identifying number in the immigration system. You have to gather those documents. And of course, you need a plan for your kids, right? Mm. You need to figure out how to designate an individual just in case. Now, in New York State, there's a form called the OCFS 4909 form. It's put out by the Office of Family and Children's Services. And that form is a form that will allow you to designate an individual just in case. You have to have a plan. You have to be prepared. That's the most important thing. Preparation, education is key here.
That's Juana Cortez de Torres, Immigration Legal Rights Project Director at Rural and Migrant Ministry. There's more information at ruralmigrantministry.org. Juana, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Now, more on this story. Two people accused of stealing groceries in an upstate suburb are now facing deportation. From the New York Public News Network, WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports the arrest highlights the consequences when local police cooperate with federal immigration agents.
2121, just be advised as well.
It started as a routine police call for shoplifting.
1400 Altamont Avenue, the Hannaford. We have a Hispanic couple with a stroller loaded up with merchandise.
Officers in Rotterdam, a town of about 30,000 outside Schenectady, found two people in the cramped security office of a local grocery store one morning this March. Staff said the suspects, Michael and Maria, took things like rice, beans, bread, and olive oil. They hid them under a stroller carrying Maria's child. The total value was $159. But a relatively minor charge escalated when officers checked Michael's ID.
You policy in my country.
You are?
In my country.
In his country, he's a police officer.
In my country, free police here.
He provided an expired ID showing he was a police officer in Nicaragua.
How long?
People are often ticketed rather than arrested when accused of shoplifting. Police only take suspects in if they can't verify their identity.
I'm kind of torn as to since he's got ID.
The patrol officer called his supervisor. A detective called ICE.
Said, because this guy's got the police ID and stuff, he said, he goes, don't do anything with them until I call you back.
What you just heard is one of the first known cases under the federal Laken Riley Act in New York State. President Trump signed it into law earlier this year.
Today, the Department of Homeland Security will be required to detain all illegal aliens who have been arrested for theft, burglary, larceny, shoplifting, assaulting a police officer, murder.
But according to Lauren DeRosier, who runs the immigration clinic at Albany Law School, the statute only places requirements on federal officers who learn about arrests. It doesn't require local police departments to call ICE.
I think it's a very sad case, and I think that it demonstrates how quickly things can escalate for people who don't have immigration status.
She supports state legislation called the New York for All Act. The bill would let local police help ICE with serious felony offenses or a judicial warrant. But if ICE just issued a detainer request, like with Michael and Maria, police would have to stand down.
We're going to pass New York for All together. Thank you.
Shut it down!
Hundreds of people keep coming to the state capitol to demonstrate in support of the legislation, which would basically make New York a sanctuary state. Here's Bronx Assemblymember Amanda Septimo at a recent rally.
If we have a federal government that is hell-bent on leading with cruelty instead of love, then we don't need to help them. In fact, we have a responsibility to resist.
Proponents are still pushing for some kind of action in the final days of Albany's lawmaking session. But top Democratic leaders, including Governor Kathy Hochul, haven't signed on. Hochul is trying to walk a fine line on immigration cooperation.
I want to make sure we get rid of people who are seriously committing crimes, but leave the rest alone. They already made it here. They're part of our family, and this is where it's a huge divide.
The Trump administration is cracking down on sanctuary jurisdictions, and Hochul will testify before Congress later this week about New York's immigration policies. In Albany, GOP lawmakers support a bill that would require local police departments to call ICE if they arrest an undocumented immigrant. State Senator Andrew Lanza represents Staten Island. He says departments who don't call are essentially obstructing justice.
Sanctuary state means we're not complying with federal law.
He renamed his state bill after the Laken Riley law. If an immigrant already broke the law to enter the U.S., Lanza says any subsequent offense is worse.
To me, it's even more egregious. You have somebody that not only broke into the country, but now you committed a crime.
For now, municipalities around New York State have a hodgepodge of rules. Rotterdam police leaders say they don't have a specific policy on dealing with non-citizens. But in the case of Michael and Maria, they proactively call ICE. Officers took Michael back to the station without incident. They charged him with shoplifting and endangering the welfare of a child because Maria's 3-year-old daughter was with the couple at the grocery store. But the arrest took a turn when officers handed Michael over to federal agents. Surveillance footage shows he slipped out of his handcuffs and tried to walk away.
Hold on.
Hold on. Your hands.
I got my hands right there.
6 federal and local police officers used a taser to rearrest Michael. Court records allege an ICE agent suffered a bruised jaw. Michael is charged with assaulting a federal officer. During the scuffle, he kept shouting out in Spanish that he had ID. He says, I have a social security number, immigration papers. The officers didn't respond.
Stop moving!
Michael is currently at a jail near Albany. His federal case is pending, and his lawyer declined to comment. Maria and her daughter first came to Rotterdam in 2023. They were bused to a motel there by New York City officials after immigrating from Colombia. Maria's legal representative declined to comment, but she's now in federal custody without her child.
I know we're going to get mommy, I promise.
Body camera footage captures the girl crying in the back seat of a police cruiser as her mother was being processed. Police turned her over to social services. In Rotterdam, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the New Paltz Pride Coalition is bringing visibility, celebration, and a safe space to the Hudson Valley. Tonight, they co-host a screening of Janice Ian, Breaking the Silence, at the Rosendale Theater. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar speaks with Coalition co-founder Eve Papp about honoring queer icons and building lasting community support. Next, this is Radio Chatskill.
The same organism emerging at around the same time in 4 parts of the world.
On the next Radiolab.
It wasn't a bacteria or a virus.
Climate change brings a newcomer to our bodies.
What's it doing in our hospital, behaving so angrily?
They had to close their intensive care unit for months.
It's popping up all over the world.
It's definitely not normal.
Join us for the next Radiolab. This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year. NACL.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Tonight, the New Paltz Pride Coalition co-hosts a special documentary honoring singer-songwriter Janice Ian's life. It's at the Rosendale Theater as part of their lineup of Pride Month events. The documentary, Janice Ian, Breaking the Silence, is named after her 1993 album where she publicly came out as a lesbian. New Paltz Pride Coalition is a haven for the LGBTQIA plus community in New Paltz, currently working to create a dedicated center for folks to gather. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Eisauer spoke with Eve Papp, co-founder and board president of the New Paltz Pride Coalition, about what they have lined up for June and why creating safe spaces is more important than ever.
Why don't we start with just learning more about New Paltz Pride Coalition? Can you tell me more about the organization and some of the events that you have lined up for June for Pride Month?
So the New Paltz Pride Coalition started about 2 years ago is when we really got underway. And it just kind of started because New Paltz has always had, at least for the last few decades, a very prominent queer community. And it has a big community, but me and some other people had noticed that we never had a home base. There's no center in town. There was New Paltz Pride once a year, and kind of that day would come and go, and that would be about it. And we realized with such a big community, why are we not doing more events? Why was there not a center people could drop into for questions?
I'd love to hear a little bit more about some of the upcoming events that you have lined up for the month, specifically the documentary highlighting Janice Ian's career at the Rosendale Theater. Who was Janice Ian and why is she so important for the LGBTQIA community?
Well, the first part is our big thing, actually, for Pride was we just did our Pride March yesterday. We kicked off Pride. We do the first Sunday in June. This march has now happened for 21 years, so it was a fantastic kickoff. And strangely enough, I need to say, I'm actually really excited for this film. I don't know that much about her. So, I mean, I know some of her songs, obviously, like 17 was a very big one, which has always resonated. But she was somebody who came out in the early 90s as a lesbian, which was, you know, before a lot of people really had been coming out. And in the music industry, she was very outspoken with her songs, with her activism, with her support of kind of equality for everybody. And unfortunately, when she was doing this, this was before a lot of radio stations were really ready for this. And it was before a lot of people were ready for it. So there was, you know, a lot of pushback, and, you know, as they pushed back, she kept standing up for what she believed was right. And that's why I'm actually very excited to go to this screening, because I really want to know more of her story. And that's what I think this is going to be about. I think it's going to be a great way for people who do know about her to, you know, see more of her life. And for those of us who don't know about her to really learn more, because I think it's so important for us to, you know, learn from our elders and learn about, you know, who's come before us and what they've done for us and how we can keep doing more.
Definitely. And can you remind folks when this upcoming documentary is?
This is going to be, it's actually coming up at the Rosendale Theater.
And the Rosendale Theater is on 408 Main Street in Rosendale, New York. I want to take a couple steps back because I know you mentioned that on Sunday was the Pride kickoff for New Paltz Pride Coalition. Tell me more about how that was, if you could describe the energy of the event.
I mean, I've been going to New Paltz Pride since full time, pretty much since about 2017. I had been there in past years more as a spectator. I hadn't come out myself until 2017, so I had not been like an active part of it before then. But since I've been marching as myself for the last 7-8 years now in the parade, and it was, Pride has always been great. It's always a fantastic day. The march is always, you know, powerful. It's always a great time. But this year's Pride March, just the words everyone kept saying was it hit differently.
Wow.
You know, there's so much more at stake this year. There's so much more that people are worried about. There's so much more need for a community this year. And one of the most beautiful things was Stephen and Patrick, who run Big Gay Hudson Valley, had the world's largest trans flag sewn up for their event, which was the walkway over the Hudson Pride in the Sky just a few short weeks ago. And they've now been lending the flag out. So we were the first march to actually get the flag after them. And seeing a 120-foot-long trans flag going down Main Street of New Paltz, and just seeing the faces of the flag carriers that we were able to recruit, and seeing the faces of the people on the side of the road, and just you could see the emotion in their eyes. It was so absolutely incredible. It was, I mean, this, I don't want to sound biased because I probably am in this sense, but was probably the favorite Pride I have been to. I mean, I don't remember a Pride having this much emotion to it, having this much of a feeling, having this much of a need. It was just such a powerful, powerful event. It was such a supportive atmosphere. The people were so happy. We had great queens doing their thing. We had younger people doing some readings about how they're feeling. We had proclamations from the governor. We had so many people that were there to speak, and, you know, Resisterhood singing for us again, and just Jay Blotcher, our Grand Marshal, and Phoenix, who is our voice of the future. And it was just such an inspiring, inspiring day.
As you highlighted, having these safe and inclusive spaces for queer and trans communities is even more important right now, as we're seeing protections being rolled back for the LGBTQIA community at the federal level. We talked about this kickoff being especially special this year, and I'm curious what you're hearing from the broader community in the Hudson Valley and Catskill regions just about how they're feeling right now.
A lot of people are scared. There's a lot of uncertainty, too, because what this administration is trying to pull off, and I will say, I am not a lawyer, but what they are illegally trying to pull off in this country, and how they are trying to pretty much bully everybody back into the closet and lock everybody else's closet doors, there's people who are rightfully afraid. But at the same time, watching so many people just, and especially, you know, the elders who are really, really amazing to me, just pick up their old protest signs and go back out and saying, you know, no, we're not. We've done this before. We're still here and we're going to be here again in the future. But we got to go through this nonsense again. To see the younger people starting to come out, you know, and really get involved in this is such a beautiful thing. I hate to see it because the reason we're seeing it's a bad reason, but at the same time, I love to see it. I love to see the community coming back together. You know, there's some queer bars in the area that I've been going out to lately, and just to see the entire community like just out and dancing, and just knowing that during the day we're struggling so much, but, you know, at night we come together and we're like, all right, we're here. We have each other, and that's the most important part right now. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. There's the fear on one side, but, you know, as they're building the fear, they don't realize their mistake, because as they're building the fear, we're building our community off of it. And they might think they have us right now, but the game has just started, and we will keep fighting and we will prevail.
Well, June is Pride Month. But this, of course, is not the only time to celebrate queer joy and be part of the LGBTQIA community here in the region. I'm curious if you want to share a little bit more about how people can learn more about your work and what else the New Paltz Pride Coalition is up to.
So the main way, if you want to learn about us, is either everything is just New Paltz Pride Coalition. We have a website, newpaltzpridecoalition.org. Because we are a 501c3 registered organization. If you prefer social media, we are both on Facebook and Instagram at New Paltz Pride Coalition. In terms of what we're continuing to do this month, we have the blessing of having gone first for Pride, which is never a blessing beforehand because we have to do it first, which is always difficult. However, the nice thing is once we have done Pride, which ours is now behind us, we're going to spend every weekend going from Pride March to Pride March to Pride March and either tabling at the events or marching in the events. I think we have Kingston and Woodstock coming up this weekend. We have Poughkeepsie the weekend after. New York City, obviously, is going to be a big one at the very end of June. They're always the last week right around the Stonewall anniversary. This month is going to be a lot of going around having fun. I will say then once July and August shows up, we sometimes get a little bit quiet and we take our break after all of this work. Then we'll be starting back up either August or September. And, you know, we're going to have a lot of little things again, too. We do a costume swap for the town every year. You don't need to bring a costume to get a free costume. Costumes are one of the biggest wastes in October. The amount of people that buy a costume 1 year, throw it out after one use, and then spend more money to buy a new costume next year to throw out after one use. So we do a holidays party for families at SUNY New Paltz in the end of or middle of December. So we have a lot of things, but, you know, one thing I always push people is there is a reason it's called the New Paltz Pride Coalition, because the group of us that are working on it and running it, we don't want this just to be what we want to do. The whole point of this is if, you know, I've had people come up to me saying, hey, can you make a seniors group of people over 65? And I say, I would love that. I'm not over 65, so I don't want to be the one running it. But if you would like to run it, if you'd like to get some friends together, if you'd like to make a thing, let us help. We have a very good social media following right now. We have some funds. We know places where we could set up meetings for people. We could really help whatever groups people want to get off the ground. You know, all we say is, like, give us some help if you want to help run it or you know someone that does. We would love to have you come out and start a group with us. And, you know, we try some of our own groups time to time, like trans support groups, family support groups. So, you know, join us. That's why this is a coalition. This is, we want all different groups coming together and we want to support you. You support us. And that's how community works.
You can find more information on these events and how to plug in on newpaltzpridecoalition.org. We've been chatting with Eve Papp, board president and co-founder of the New Paltz Pride Coalition. Eve, thank you so, so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Kimberly Izar for that. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, Joe Johnson with Science Stories. This is Radio Chatskill.
Have you heard what your neighbors are saying about the threat to public media?
I think that's totally unacceptable.
WJFF connects our whole community together.
We depend on truth. We depend on accuracy. And we depend on fair press.
I'm definitely protesting against any cuts to our local station.
Public radio is under threat, and the stakes have never been higher. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org and tell Congress to protect Radio Catskill while there's still time.
It's Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Joe Johnson is our resident science guy who brings us science stories that caught his eye, and including this report today with NASA's Dragonfly passing a key test. It'll take a look at its upcoming mission to Saturn's moon. Scientists explained the real reason fingers get pruney in water and pre-colonial farming.
So this came from the June 5th issue of the journal Science, an investigation of the methods and scale of pre-colonial farming by the indigenous Menominee people in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's that area called the 60 Islands. It's a pretty well-known archaeological site, and it's been known that the ancestors of the Menominee tribe lived there and farmed there for a long time, but they were not aware of the scale of what was going on. Now, the paper details the use of LIDAR to make a very precise topographic map of the area. LIDAR stands for light detection and ranging. Basically, they use pulses of laser light to map the surface. It's on a drone, and it maps the surface very, very precisely. Okay, now you might be familiar with radar, which is using radio waves, actually microwaves, or sonar, which uses sound waves to map things underwater. Well, this is LIDAR. And they use bursts of laser light, and they detect the exact shape of the earth, and it ignores all of the vegetation. So all you're looking at is a topographic map, a very, very fine detailed topographic map of the surface of the earth. So the map, when they looked at it, revealed this amazing patchwork of raised garden beds. And the scale of it was what I think took the scientists back, because we're talking about 95 hectares, which would be about 230 acres,
which would be about 2 square kilometers. And this is just how they gardened. This is how they raised their crops, primarily maize, bean, and squash. And they know that because as soon as they saw this, they, of course, went out and they started excavating these beds. And they found a couple of things, what they had been raising, because they found some residue of them. Maize, bean, and squash, of course, are the three sisters, well known for the indigenous people farming. But they also found melons and sunflowers, too. And it was really, really interesting to me, not only the size of it, but just, and I looked at my own garden and, you know, my beds are 3 feet wide and these beds were about a meter wide, which is right around 3 feet wide. So I have a little in common with them.
And the scientists used drones to help cover this entire area.
To map the area. Yeah, absolutely.
And it corrects a bit of a narrative that some people might have in their minds of Native Americans as just hunter-gatherers. They were extensive farmers.
They were. They thought that they had been gathering a lot of wild rice and other wild grains. They didn't realize that they were, you know, such indigenous or such prodigious farmers, I wanted to say. They found that the Menominee added compost, you know, from their households, and wetland soils. They would actually bring in wetland soils to enrich the soil, to make the soil richer.
So this is just this one area of the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. Do scientists think that this might be the tip of the iceberg and there's much, much more?
It possibly could be. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of the archaeological sites will have been lost to modern farming or, you know, urbanization, where cities get built on these sites.
I wonder what they were doing with all this food that they were growing and who was consuming all of it.
Well, that's the thing. They have not found the village yet where the people lived. Mm-hmm. And you wonder if they were using this for, you know, a lot of this stuff for trade or what the story was. It also makes you think about the division of labor and how did they accomplish such a large scale farming endeavor. Now, it looks like this site was in use for farming like this for about 600 years. From about 1000 AD until about 1600 AD. And after that, I think it's probably, European colonization that may have disrupted it.
Science Stories with Joe Johnson would not be complete without a story from space.
Absolutely.
We have an update on NASA's Dragonfly nuclear powered helicopter.
Yes.
It's going to try to figure out what's going on Saturn's moon Titan.
Saturn's largest moon Titan.
It's cleared a key hurdle ahead of this.
It has. We've talked about the Ingenuity helicopter before, if you remember, that flew on Mars, made 72 flights over almost 3 years and lasted quite a bit longer than they thought it was going to. This new mission is, like you said, is going to fly on Titan. Now, Titan is about half the size of the Earth's diameter, but it only has about 1/7 of the Earth's gravity. It has a very, very dense atmosphere, about 4.5 times denser than the Earth's atmosphere. In fact, it's the only moon that has a really significant atmosphere. We can't see the surface because of the atmosphere. There are large clouds of methane in the atmosphere. It's so cold that methane, natural gas, is actually found in all three phases on the surface of Titan. And in fact, they think that there is a methane cycle going on Titan. Just like we have a water cycle on Earth, they think that it rains liquid methane, that there are lakes and rivers of methane on the surface of Titan, and that there's actually solid methane too, frozen methane.
Why is studying Titan a high priority for scientists?
Well, they think that it could be an analog for a very early Earth. And, you know, a lot of the chemistry is going to be the same. A lot of the conditions are going to be the same. Now, we do have some information on Titan already. Back in 2004, the Cassini probe that actually went to Saturn and studied the area dropped a probe into the surface, into the atmosphere called Huygens. And Huygens on the way down sent back lots of data on the atmosphere, winds, temperature, pressure, composition, but it also took pictures of the surface on the way down, and it looks a lot like the Earth. It has bodies of liquid and river systems on the surface. And we think, like I said, that this is methane, that this is natural gas, what we would on Earth call natural gas.
Well, now, when you say it's like Earth, does that mean that there could potentially have been some form of life?
You never know. I mean, it is very, very cold, and the chemistry is unknown to us, but you never know. The interesting thing, though, is that Titan's surface is not continuous with its interior. In other words, the surface is moving. It moved about 20 miles in about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that there is a frozen crust floating on a liquid ocean, and that liquid ocean could indeed be water. And if there's water and there's heat, and there certainly is, you could get life forming. The Cassini probe did notice that there were geysers coming out down near the south pole of Titan, and I will bet that that is on one of the lists of the things that they want to go and visit once they get there.
You know, if there was life there and with that water, you know what would happen?
What's that?
Pruny fingers.
Pruny fingers.
Which is the segue into our next story. Pruny fingers that you get after, like, soaking in a bath.
Absolutely. This is the time of year when we all end up with pruny fingers after we've been swimming in the lake or wherever.
Or water, yeah.
Yeah. It's commonly thought that and it would happen when your fingers swell up, but that's not actually what happens. This comes from the May 2025 issue of the Journal of the Mechanical Behavior of Biomedical Materials, which is a journal I had never heard of before. And it actually happens when the skin shrinks due to vasoconstriction. The constriction of blood vessels pulls the skin tighter, and it makes this pruny pattern. And the question is, why? Well, this phenomenon actually has a name, a scientific name. It's called water-induced finger wrinkling. And, of course, it has an acronym, WFIW. And it happens when water is absorbed into the skin, and this actually lowers the salt content of the fluid between the cells in your skin. And that signals the brain to begin vasoconstriction because it realizes it's in water. Now, we know that this is determined or controlled by the nervous system because subjects that have a damaged median nerve, and median nerve runs up your wrist and into your palm, and if you've damaged that nerve, your fingers will not prune in water. Mm. I thought that was a pretty interesting point. Yeah. So what's the purpose of this? What's the evolutionary background? Well, it improves your grip strength in water. And we kind of know that because that's the only part of your body that prunes up. The back of your hand doesn't prune up,
right?
You know, arms don't prune up. It's just your fingertips, so that if you're in a water environment, you have greater grip. I wonder if the pads of your toes prune up.
Do they?
I don't know. I'm going to check next time I go swimming. No.
We're going to do our own scientific research here.
Yes.
I thought it was also fascinating about this study was that a student had asked this question, which prompted mm-hmm. these researchers to study even more, not that your fingers prune up, but that they prune up in the same pattern.
Yeah, yeah. What they did is they got three grad students, and they had them stick their hands in 104-degree water, which is like hot tub warm, for about 30 minutes. They pulled them out, they dried them off, and they photographed them and mapped the surfaces very, very carefully. The next day, 24 hours later, they repeated the experiment, and they got the same exact pattern. And they think it's because the blood vessels that are constricting, they don't move around. They're in the same spot, and so they're going to pull the skin in the same way and give you the same pattern every time.
Mm. What was the acronym again?
WFIW, water-induced finger wrinkling.
Maybe they should add that to, like, law enforcement's database, like, with fingerprints pruned or unpruned.
wait, you got to take a half an hour to take your fingerprints here.
Put them in the bath.
They did have a couple questions. You know, would this remain consistent over the years if you took somebody's, wrinkly prints today and 20 years from now, would they be the same? And they did say that there could be something having to do with forensics. So who knows where, research like this is going to lead you.
Joe Johnson, always fascinating with the science stories from our ancestors farming to the outer reaches of space to our pruny fingers in the water.
Pruny fingers, absolutely.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Now, as summer arrives, music will once again fill the air in Wayne County at the Wayne County Creative Arts Council's Summer Concert Series in Honesdale Central Park. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Mitzi Keeler, project manager at Wayne County Creative Arts Council, for more.
Welcome to Radio Chatskill, Mitzi. As program manager for the Wayne County Creative Arts Council, I am sure you are very busy getting set up for your summer concert series. So tell us a bit about what we can expect.
We have 14 free concerts, or I should say free will concerts, and we have a big variety of genres of music.
What kinds of music could we look forward to?
Okay, we go all the way from barbershoppers to rock and roll. We have some classic rock and roll with the Luongo Brothers. We have a symphonic band with the Crystal Band on our July 1st, but we call it Independence Day Celebration. We have country, we have modern rock and roll, and old-time fiddlers, which is one of our most popular.
And how long have you been involved with the organization?
Probably since the 80s sometime.
What got you involved?
My best friend was involved, and so I've carried on after she passed away. But really, my husband was involved back in the early 70s, because at that time, the Arts Council was also sponsoring a summer musical production at the high school. So he did that for a number of years. I helped him with painting the sets and that sort of thing. We've had an art show. We've had, you know, various different types of presentations. But for the last, I would say, 20 years, we've been in the park.
And that's a very well-attended event, if I remember correctly.
Yes, yes. We had, our first concert is actually going to be held now in the Methodist Church on Church Street, simply because it involves handbells, which are very expensive and hard to move. That also, we don't want them exposed to the weather. So we have the barbershoppers and the handbells, that concert. That everything else we hope to have in the park. Actually have built in for the first time possible rain dates where we can reschedule concerts, and we also have a number of places that we can move if it's going to rain.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about those bells.
They are made up of basically people who play handbells in their churches. And this is a choir, or group, I should say, that has gotten together for, I'm not even sure how long. But they perform on that first concert. It's a real combination of things that they do, some religious, some secular, some popular. It's just a very popular concert.
And what is the issue with being exposed to the weather?
The bells are very expensive. And if they had to pack up quickly, which you've had to do a number of times, or just with a threat of rain, not knowing whether we're going to go over there or be someplace else, it takes a long time for them to set up their tables and the bells themselves. So it just is easier to say our first concert is going to be at the Methodist Church.
That's quite an endeavor.
It is. It really is.
What other types of events does the WCCAC sponsor?
It's basically the summer concert. We've worked with the Honesdale Park and Rec to get the stage up and running, and we're hoping to get some more lighting and so forth this year, too. The fellow that does our booking the music, he's also our sound and light person, I guess you'd say. And we wrote a grant to get money to provide more sound equipment and lighting equipment to help get the stage all set up. The stage is a very interesting thing. It has to be put up by somebody who really knows what they're doing, and it's supposed to be collapsed one or two times during the season, which means getting stuff off the stage, this person coming in and taking care of it. And it takes, you know, several hours to get it down and then back up.
Wow. Well, this is a real labor of love for the community.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have a bunch of volunteers. Our board has 9 members on it, and they've been with us for years. We've picked up a couple new members in the last few years. And then when it comes time to put out our brochures and so forth, we have volunteers that just say, oh, I'll do it.
Well, it's always wonderful to hear about events that involve the community and are enjoyed by the community. So I want to thank you for taking the time to share this with us and all the work that you and other members of the council have to put in to bring this great series of concerts to Honesdale.
Well, I appreciate you recognizing us.
You are welcome.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi for that report. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.